62. Ready appliance.
Warden, they breached the hangar containment barriers. Siddiqui glanced up from the medbay support console to the guard whose name she couldn't recall at the moment. Stretching the mechanized orthoprosthesis that the GH7 had just finished stat grafting onto her ankle, she winced with pain. The initial round of medication was already wearing off, but that was good. She could feel her mind clearing.
How many are there?
42. Including Jabba's own bodyguards? The guard nodded. All still heavily armed. The guard stole a furtive glance at her foot, then looked back up at her face. We've sealed off the main level, closed the cell blocks, and put Genpop into lockdown. But what? Well, that last reconfiguration sequence that you ordered, The guard hesitated. It opened up a whole wing of unfinished throughways, and some of those places aren't secure.
No hatchways?
No hatchways, no airlocks. Some of the guys are saying they don't even have surveillance out that far.
They're right, Siddiqui said.
Withholding the truth now wouldn't help any of them. How many of our people are left? I spoke to Captain Garvey 5 minutes ago. He's reporting heavy losses from the hangar. How many?
The guard swallowed.
36 guards that we know of. Maybe more if they haven't had a chance to respond.
His face became pale.
And we're running low on firepower.
Where's my brother?
Nobody's seen him for several hours.
Get a search party together.
Siddiqui rose to her feet. Contact me as soon as you find him.
Warden, where are you going?
Get the escape pod ready, she said.
Tell him I'll meet him there.
Sojourn. Your delivery has been received,
11-4D said. Darth Plagueis turned to look back at the droid.
The replacement geological compressor?
That's right, Master.
Somewhere beneath the transpirator mask that covered his mouth, Plagueis permitted himself a smile. He and the droid were making their way through the Coldstone research chambers where he'd spent whole months of his time, working with unswerving purpose among the various species that he kept caged up.
Thank you, 4D.
Plagueis focused his attention on the vat in front of him, where the remains of the Bith Sith Lord, Darth Venomous, floated in a semi-transparent bath of preserving fluid. Venomous's corpse was still animated and twitching spasmodically with the last dregs of life that Plagueis invested in it, only to snatch it away again. He had been working for almost 20 uninterrupted hours on this particular project, with limited success, and the notification from his droid signified a welcome diversion.
Did Slipher confirm its arrival?
He asked.
Not exactly, Master,
the droid replied.
Why not?
Because it appears that Mr. Slipher is dead.
Oh.
Plagueis pondered the news for a moment, before turning to face the droid.
Did Maul kill him?
No, Master. From what I was able to glean from surveillance uploads from the prison, Mr. Slipher was killed instantly when a CLL binary loadlifter decapitated him.
The droid paused.
And then crushed him underfoot.
A humble end for such a promising mind.
4D let out a small electronic gurgle.
I'm not sure that I take your meaning.
It's unimportant,
Plagueis replied, and scratched his chin in thought.
A droid, you say?
Yes. I'm sure it was accidental. It was the same droid, in fact, that you had tasked to deliver the package directly to the Zabrak.
Ah.
Plagueis beamed with pleasure.
So Maul has everything he needs to facilitate his mission, then. You're sure?
I've confirmed it through surveillance holo footage,
11-4D said, and then paused for a moment,
If I may inquire, what was the purpose of keeping this information from Master Sidious?
That is an excellent question, 4D. I suppose you could say for the purpose of strengthening our relationship.
Sir?
Between Lord Sidious and myself.
Plagueis returned his attention to the Bith in the vat before him, although his thoughts were now far away from the resurrected Venomous.
The Zabrak's assassination mission inside the prison is of great interest to me. As you know, I have extended a great deal of latitude to Lord Sidious in the past.
Reaching out with the dark side, Plagueis watched in a distracted way as Venomous's lifeless face stirred in the viscous chemical soup, one eye opening and rolling up to gaze at him. Then he continued.
Especially now, as we approach the pivotal moment in our plans for Palpatine's impending chancellorship, I find his increasing tendency toward self-reliance to be disturbing. Of course, the time will come when I will let him know that I was the one who provided Iram Radik with the fully functional geological compressor that he needed, and thus allowed Maul to complete his mission. But the moment of revelation is not yet ripe.
'64, the tombs.
Alarms were going off everywhere. Beaten unconscious and left for dead by Jabba's men in the alley adjacent to the Purge's holding cells, Bisley Cloth finally opened his eyes and staggered to his feet, stirred by the shattering klaxons that were ringing out from somewhere in the ship's bridge. He drew a breath and summoned his resolve. His last memory had been of coming down to check on his 39 passengers, who had fallen so ominously silent. Now he found himself staring down at the ragged semicircular hole that had been cut through the vessel's lower hull, leading to the interior of a completely unfamiliar and ornately designed space yacht. Looking down into it, Cloth seized upon the full extent of what had happened with a dreadful clarity. The ship that had attached itself to the Purge was the same yacht that he'd spotted in the middle distance during their approach to Coghive 7. They'd been boarded, which meant the passengers had come with the explicit purpose of facilitating a breakout of... He swung around, pushing his way through the open hatch leading to the holding cells themselves. They stood empty. The prisoners were out.
No!
Cloth's burgeoning sense of dread only seemed to amplify the alarms in the Purge's flight deck. Shaking off the last of his disorientation, he flung himself up the steps, through the gangway, and nearly tripped over the corpse of one of the crewmen sprawled in front of him in a pool of his own blood. The other guard lay face down, 2 meters farther up the corridor. Cloth ran the rest of the way to the bridge and stopped in his tracks. Here the ship's interior reeked of blaster fire and overheated wires. In front of him, the Purge's captain, Wyatt Styrene, sat harnessed into the swivel seat in front of the ship's command suite, his head bowed in apparent contemplation of their fate. Captain! Cloth said, grabbing Styrene's shoulder, and Styrene's head tilted back to reveal his slashed throat. It was only the harness itself that had kept him from tumbling out of his seat. Cloth's reflexes took over. Hardly pausing to consider what he was doing, he unbuckled Styrene's body and dragged it away from the Purge's controls. He seated himself in the pilot's chair and glanced at the screens in front of him, gazing at the prison's cargo bay, to which the prison barge was still attached. What he saw on the monitors made his heart vault up into his throat. Although he could make out very little from this angle, it appeared as though the entire hangar was littered with dead prison guards, dozens of them. In the midst of it, somewhere in the foreground, a shape, Cloth thought it was a hut, sat atop a repulsor platform, gesturing at two Gamorreans as they gathered up weapons from the floor. What was going on? There was a sudden concussion from below. like an echo of what had happened earlier. Something else hit the Purge, slamming into it hard enough to shake it from its mooring. And in an instant, all the barge's controls and monitors went dead, plunging Cloth into blackness. Reaching forward, his hand scrambled blindly for the controls, struggling to reactivate them, but it was pointless. The Purge creaked around him. From down below the barge's hull came the brittle snapping noises of steel valves being ripped away, followed by an enormous whooshing pop as the vacuum-sealed suction coupling mechanism broke completely open. Cloth's thoughts flashed to the space yacht that had affixed itself to their hull like a parasite, the pirates who had cut their way into the hold. Then he knew. Dropping to his hands and knees in the darkness, he fumbled his way out of the bridge and down toward the concourse below, moving more quickly now, going purely by memory and sense of touch. By the time he'd reached the corpses of the guards, he sensed that he was very close indeed. Cloth stopped, adrenaline flooding through his body, trying to catch his breath. Slowly, he rose to his feet. Sickly green auxiliary lights illuminated the ragged hole in the Purge's lower level. But when Cloth looked down through the hole, he no longer saw the lavishly appointed interior of the space yacht. It simply wasn't there anymore. Something or someone had pried it away, leaving only the ragged hole. But the hole wasn't empty. Cloth stepped back, feeling a low, atavistic horror crawling its way from his belly up into the pit of his throat. Something was coming up through the hole, dragging itself toward him, a figure like nothing he'd seen before. Even among the inmates and wildly varying galactic scum he'd transported from every system imaginable. Cloth stared at it for a moment, held rapt by a power he could neither identify nor resist. The thing's head was covered with a skull, with long, sharpened horns protruding out from either side. The hollow sockets where its eyes should have been shone with a primordial blue light. That's madness. The color of madness. Whether this was a mask or actually its face, Cloth had no intention of sticking around to find out, particularly as it became clear that the thing hadn't come alone. The hole was full of floating blue eyes. They were making their way up into the Purge, and now Cloth saw that he had nowhere to go. And that, in all the time he'd had since waking up on the floor outside the containment cells, he'd failed to secure a weapon for himself. And now it was too late. The things moved toward him like an army of the dead, with terrible determination and strength. Cloth took a step back and stumbled over the body of a guard, failing to catch himself before toppling backward against something sharp and angular. When he looked up again, the skull-faced things had surrounded him.
"Where is he?"
a female voice asked. Cloth looked up at her. The woman in front of him had a shock of pure white hair that seemed to bristle straight upward from her forehead, which only accentuated the expression of dark intensity etched deeply across her face. She had weird, chemical yellow eyes, the color of a dying, toxic sun. Under other circumstances, Cloth thought he might have found her striking, even beautiful. Although right now he was sure, absolutely positive in fact, that she could have murdered him without a qualm.
"Who?"
"The one I've come to meet."
I don't know who that is," Cloth managed. "I don't know who you are."
Staring at her, he fought a wild, irrational impulse to try to explain how all of this must have been some terrible mistake, and how this woman and her skull-faced army must have been in the wrong place entirely.
"This is just a prison barge. I'm only the navigator. I don't know..." Ah!
The slap across his face knocked him back to reality.
"I am Komari Voza,"
the female said.
"And this is the Bando Gora. We've come to acquire a weapon."
Sixty-five. As below, so above.
Which way is it?
Egan asked. Maul didn't answer. For the past 5 minutes, they'd been heading down a concourse that had looked familiar, but the reconfiguration had changed everything. For all he knew, it wasn't over, and the prison was going to continue rearranging itself until it ripped itself to pieces.
Maybe that's the whole idea.
He threw back his head and made a sharp cawing sound, a sound that he'd now heard frequently enough to be able to mimic with some accuracy.
What are you?
Maul held up his hand for silence, cocked his head, and listened. The sound came back to him, an imperfect echo of the shrill cry.
Duck your head.
What?
Egan frowned.
Why?
A sudden flurry of activity came bursting down the corridor. Maul crouched down as a great dark cloud of clawbirds swept through the length of the corridor in an almost solid wave, cawing and shrieking as they came. He tucked the package under his arm and ran after the birds with the boy at his heels. The flock flew even faster as a collective unit, spiraling and diving downward through the newly reconfigured passageways of the lowermost levels, swirling like smoke through the chambers of some great mechanical nautilus. Maul could see where they were going. It was coming now, very near. He saw the door ahead of him, watched the birds funneling down through it. Maul leapt through, the boy just behind him. They landed back in a familiar place, the weapon shop where he'd stood not long before. Coyle was still there, his rodent nose twitching anxiously. The blaster that he'd used to kill Dakari Blur was still gripped tightly in his hands.
Jagannath,
the Chadrafan said, eyeing the package under Maul's arm.
We were beginning to worry you hadn't been successful in your quest, weren't we?
He glanced back over his shoulder, where a tall figure stood behind the counter. The tall man stepped into the light.
The outcome was never in doubt, he said, and gazed at Maul. Greetings, Jagannath. I'm Iram Radik.
'66. Hush.
In the end, Siddiqui had no choice. Yes, the escape pod was prepped and waiting for her. 4D was already there, and perhaps Dakari too, if they'd found him. Communications were failing fast. Whole relay sections were going down. Radio transmissions had already been reduced to static. As much as she needed to get out of here, Siddiqui knew that she had to go back to her office one last time. There was a final detail that needed taking care of. She stepped through the hatchway and paused long enough to look across the office. Even now, in the midst of everything that was happening, Siddiqui felt a creator's wistful appreciation for the prison. The project that she and her brother had designed together, the algorithm into which Dakari had breathed life, and the sheer elegance of the plan itself. It had been almost perfect. Only the persistent rumors of the existence of Iram Radik, that incorporeal galactic bogeyman whose base of operations was allegedly somewhere inside the prison, had marred the otherwise perfect machine of money and violence that was the Hive. Not that it mattered now. The experiment had served its purpose. Soon, everyone inside would be dead. Then she would head for the escape pod to depart with Dakari, leaving Coghive 7 to tear itself to pieces. There would be other opportunities. Other worlds. Tapping in the command for inmate population control, Siddiqui watched as a long light of digits scrolled across the screen in numeric order, each one representing an active prisoner here. There were a little over 400 of them currently. The scum and filth of the galaxy, none of which she ever wanted to run into again. She selected the entire list and clicked a single command. Terminate. One by one, numbers began to disappear off the top of the list. For a moment she sat there, watching them vanish. It would require some time to complete, she realized. She didn't want to overload the system at this critical juncture, and she would rather be sure that every single inmate was dead before she ventured down below again. Besides, the process wouldn't take too long, perhaps only 30 minutes or so, until it reached the highest numbers. She was rising to leave the data center when something inside the wall moved. Stepping back, pushing her chair out of the way, Siddiqui gazed up uncertainly at the wall in front of her, above the monitor displays. At this point, her sensibilities were so keenly attuned to the screens and keyboards and numbers that the unexpected presence of something living, rustling, so close to her, caused the small hairs on the back of her neck to prickle. Her thoughts returned to the prison's most recent reconfiguration, initiated in her desperate last-ditch bid for self-preservation. It had been a drastic move, and if she had planned on spending any more time aboard Coghive 7, it would have been catastrophic. Instead, she simply didn't care. Except that it had resulted in some unwelcome alterations in the prison's infrastructure. Subtle, nagging changes. For example, staring at the wall in front of her, Siddiqui noticed a slight gap, perhaps 2 or 3 centimeters wide, where the pressure-treated plates hadn't joined together properly. It was a small thing, but something was moving inside the gap. Retreating swiftly from it, Siddiqui walked across the chamber and reached into the wall cabinet on the opposite side, pulling out the KYD-21 blaster pistol that she'd stashed there and had never actually planned on using. This particular model, fabricated in hadrium alloy with a guardless trigger, was one of her personal favorites. It had heavy-duty stopping power despite its size, and its cool, ridged hand grip felt good in her grasp. Siddiqui pointed it at the gap between the walls. "Who's there?" she said aloud, suddenly disliking the sound of her own voice. The quivering of her diaphragm gave it a kind of quailing tremor that she'd always found so repellent in others. A wild possibility flicked through her mind, and she took a step closer to the gap between the wall plates. "Dakari?" she said loudly. "Is that you?" Extending her arm, she tightened her finger on the trigger. "Jagannath? Have you found your way back up? You'll regret it. I guarantee that." She listened but heard nothing. Closer now, cocking her head slightly, Siddiqui leaned in toward the narrow opening and held her breath. She waited. All at once, something huge and white exploded from the wall, unfathomably large and faster than she could see, lashing outward toward her face, striking straight for her eyes. It was so big that Siddiqui's first impression was that the wall itself had somehow burst to life in front of her. Then her vision disappeared in a liquid swarm of reddish black, and the jagged corkscrew of pain went curving down to the very base of her skull, twisting down her spine to encompass her entire body. Siddiqui screamed in pain and fell to her knees, then scrambled backward across the floor. Her finger squeezed the trigger, firing off shots at random, and behind the cloak of blindness, she heard metal screeching and twisting around her, as if something bigger than she'd ever seen was dragging itself out of the wall. Then she knew what it was. The wolf worm. Clutching the blaster in her right hand, she wiped her left wrist across her eyes in an attempt to clear her vision, but she still couldn't see. If anything, the blindness had become more pervasive, overtaking whatever remained of her vision and stranding her in total blackness. Backing her way into the far corner, extending the blaster outward in her trembling grasp, she held her breath and listened for the thing's approach, tracking its advance purely by sense of sound. She could hear it. The massive weight of the thing, the sticky squelching of its advance toward her across the floor of the data center. Siddiqui fired again, three times in quick succession, and tried to remember how many rounds she'd already squeezed off. The KYD held 75 shots, so there was no immediate threat of running out of ammo. But who knew how long this would be her only weapon? Somewhere in the enervated darkness, the thing in front of her moved again. For an instant, Siddiqui almost considered making a blind run for the hatchway on the opposite side of the room. She thought she could find it from memory, but if she was wrong... She listened, visualizing it. And then, all sound disappeared. She squeezed the blaster's trigger again, felt it recoil slightly, but heard nothing. Her entire universe became one of pin-drop silence. It was as if she'd gone deaf as well as blind. All her most vital sensory organs abandoning her at the moment she needed them most. And then Siddiqui realized what was happening. Somehow, the sealed data center had put itself into silent mode. "No!" she cried into the void. But the soundproof systems devoured her voice, swallowing it whole, along with every other sonic disturbance. She had no sense of where the thing was now, how close or far away, whether it was hovering just centimeters from her face, its maw open and ready to latch onto her. Panic seized her, and she started firing randomly into the great expanse of darkness, swinging the weapon back and forth, strafing the space around her as if she could somehow shoot a hole through it, penetrating the thick layer of isolation that had left her utterly exposed here. At last, the blaster stopped recoiling, and she realized it was empty.
"No!"
Siddiqui croaked again, but heard nothing.
"No!"
This wasn't happening. Couldn't be. Not now. After she'd come so far and worked so hard to build her empire. From the beginning, she'd taken every precaution, calculated every risk, considered every angle. For all of it to end up here, with her crouched in some remote corner, blind, deaf, and mute? Tears formed in her sightless eyes, and her body started trembling. The imperfect balance of sanity tipping away from her in increments. Knees drawn up against her chest, arms extended, she gripped the useless weapon in both hands. As though, if she held onto it tightly enough, it might yet save her. She was still sitting like that when it fell upon her.